Some of history's best ideas are first dismissed as simply naive. But once in a while, all it takes is a bit of inspiration to compel a person or a small group of people to take an idea and change a nation's direction, change the world for a better place. That's what John F. Kennedy asked of young college students in 1960.
If you stayed home, you could pursue your own private interest with a good deal of assurance of success. The fact that you're willing to do this for our country and in the largest sense, as the name suggests, for the cause of peace and understanding, I think should make all Americans proud and make them all appreciative.
Kennedy had challenged students, and they answered with a proposal that Kennedy would call the Peace Corps. This hour, Kennedy and the Peace Corps, idealism on the ground. This is Kennedy and the Peace Corps, idealism on the ground. I'm Lester Graham. It's hard to imagine the underlying tension of the Cold War throughout the 1950s. Commentators, books, magazine articles by the hundreds speculated about how the world might be turned into ashes through nuclear war. The world was basically divided into three parts: the U.S. and its allies, communist countries, and the so-called Third World, the developing nations. America did not want those nations to become Marxist. U.S. officials were worried the communists would take over the world. The Soviet Union and China were reaching out to Third World countries that were then shrugging off the old colonialism of European powers. In 1951, a young congressman from Massachusetts had just returned from a tour of Asia and the Middle East. John F. Kennedy was disgusted with what he found at some of the U.S. embassies. In a speech, he criticized members of the Foreign Service who he felt were not representing the United States very well. During an appearance on NBC's Meet the Press, a 34-year-old John Kennedy was asked about that speech by a regular member of the Meet the Press panel, Lawrence Spivak.
You made a speech, and in it you said that our representatives abroad, and I quote, were unconscious of the fact that their role was not tennis and cocktails, but the interpretation to a foreign country of the meaning of American life. Well, did you find a great many of our representatives playing tennis all the time and drinking cocktails, or was that just one of those things that happened
to Kennedy? As I said in that, which you read from that speech, I said that a lot of our representatives are doing an excellent job under very difficult conditions. On the other hand, I think too many of our representatives are... I use the words playing tennis and cocktails. I think but more basically that quotation would continue in not knowing the country to which they are accredited, knowing very little of the people, very little of the language and the customs, not really representing what we would like to feel are the representative American types in the Foreign Service. I think that this has been something that's been talked about for 20 years, but I think that it's something that something ought to be done about. I think there's a lot of young men who are very interested in going in the Foreign Service. I don't know where they got a lot of the ones that I saw. Now, I don't want to condemn the Foreign Service outright because there are a lot of people who are very good and doing a terrific job. And on the other hand, and it's true all the way around the world, and any American who goes there will tell you the same thing, I think that we're not getting the representative, well-rounded type of young man to go into the Foreign Service that we should, as a rule.
Just 9 years later, in 1960, John Kennedy is a second-term U.S. senator and the Democratic nominee for president.
Kennedy,
Kennedy's campaign was capturing the imagination of young people. His New Frontier campaign theme calls for a change from the staid, some would say stale, Eisenhower administration. President Dwight Eisenhower was, of course, supporting his own vice president, the Republican candidate.
By all odds, Richard Nixon is the best qualified man to be the next president of the United States.
Along with the president, all America is going for Nixon and Lodge. Vote for them on November 8th. They understand what peace demands.
Everyone wanted peace, but how to keep the peace and at the same time limit communist influence was the real question. Nixon and Kennedy had agreed to a series of television and radio debates. The fourth debate was on foreign policy. Richard Nixon spoke first.
Since this campaign began, I have had a very rare privilege.
I have traveled to 48 of the 50 states. And in my travels, I have learned what the people of the United States are thinking about. There is one issue that stands out above all the rest, one in which every American is concerned, regardless of what group he may be a member and regardless of where he may live. And that issue, very simply stated, is this. How can we keep the peace, keep it without surrender? How can we extend freedom, extend it without war?
The Eisenhower administration's policy had been to help friendly countries with military aid and to give them money. Critics of the policy felt too often that aid went to prop up third world dictators and other authoritarian regimes. Richard Nixon thought the only way America would keep peace in the world and keep communism from spreading was through strength.
Although we are today, as Senator Kennedy has admitted, the strongest nation in the world militarily, we must increase our strength. Increase it so that we will always have enough strength that regardless of what our potential opponents have, if they should launch a surprise attack, we will be able to destroy their war-making capability. They must know, in other words, that it is national suicide if they begin anything. We need this kind of strength because we're the guardians of the peace.
There's no doubt Kennedy also believed a strong American military was key to deterring communist domination. But in Kennedy's view, America was falling short in how it treated the nations of the Third World.
I believe that the world is changing fast, and I don't think this administration has shown the foresight, has shown the knowledge, has been identified with a great fight which these people are waging to be free, to get a better standard of living, to live better. The average income in some of those countries is $25 a year. The communists say, come with us, look what we've done. And we've been, on the whole, uninterested. I think we're going to have to do better.
Kennedy felt part of America's foreign policy should be about putting our best foot forward.
And then throughout the world, appoint the best people we can get, ambassadors who can speak the language, not merely people who made a political contribution, but who can speak the language. Bring students here. Let them see what kind of a country we have. Mr. Nixon said that we should not regard them as pawns in the Cold War. We should identify ourselves with them. If that were true, why didn't we identify ourselves with the people of Africa?
As African nations had declared independence from colonial powers, the U.S. under the Eisenhower administration sometimes had been slow to recognize the new emerging governments. Between the debates, the candidates crisscrossed the country by plane and by train, campaigning to be the next president of the United States. The polls indicated it was a close race, with just weeks before the election. In mid-October, immediately after the third Nixon-Kennedy debate held in New York, Senator Kennedy flew to Michigan. He planned to sleep that night in the Student Union at the University of Michigan and campaigned by rail the next day, a 9-city whistle-stop tour through Michigan. Winning the industrial state meant a lot of electoral votes. It was really late when his plane landed, but Senator Kennedy found a crowd of 3,000 or more to greet him at the airport in Ypsilanti, Michigan. It was a quarter till 2 in the morning by the time he got to the University of Michigan, where he was to sleep.
He found 10,000 students waiting for him at 2 a.m. in the morning when he arrived after much delay. I was one of the 10,000 students there.
That's Alan Guskin. At the time, he was working on his social psychology doctorate at Michigan, and his then-wife, Judith, a grad student, was also there.
We were all excited to hear Senator Kennedy and waited in the chilly air for a long, long time. The students, the female students, were allowed to remain out from their curfew in the dorm and were very anxious to hear the senator, who we know had just finished his third debate with Nixon, and many of us had watched that debate before coming out to wait for him. When he arrived, there was great excitement. He was clearly tired. There's no question about it. He said, I came here to go to sleep, and we all said, oh, no. You know, we were afraid that he wouldn't speak at all to us.
Before Kennedy went outside to speak to the crowd, a few students approached him. They had a letter for the candidate. Tom Hayden, who was later to become an iconic activist of the 1960s, was then the editor of the campus newspaper, the Michigan Daily. Hayden says he and some of his friends have been watching a TV show about nuclear war a few nights before, and they put together a letter for Kennedy and Nixon calling for, among other things, disarmament. But it was another point in that letter that caught the candidate's eye: alternative service, a way to serve the country without being drafted into the military.
He opened the envelope, read the letter, and said, "I'll speak to one of these points tonight," put the letter back in his pocket, then went out and spoke.
John Kennedy started with an abbreviated version of his typical stump speech. But as you hear in this scratchy recording, he unexpectedly asked the students a question.
How many of you who are going to be doctors are willing to spend your days in Ghana, technicians or engineers? How many of you are willing to work in the Foreign Service and spend your lives traveling around the world? On your willingness to do that, not merely to serve 1 year or 2 years in the service, but on your willingness to contribute part of your life to this country, I think will depend the answer whether a free society can compete. I think it can, and I think Americans are willing to contribute. But the effort must be far greater than we've ever made in the past. And therefore, I'm delighted to come to Michigan, this university, because unless we have those resources in this school, unless you comprehend the nature of what is being asked of you, this country can't possibly move through the next 10 years in a period of relative strength. So I come here tonight to go to bed, but I also come here tonight to ask you to join in the effort. This university, this is the longest short speech I've ever made, and I'll therefore finish it. May I just say in conclusion that this college, this university, is not maintained by its alumni, by the state, merely to help its graduates have an economic advantage in the life struggle. There is certainly a greater purpose, and I'm sure you recognize it, and therefore I do not hesitate asking for your support in this campaign. I come here tonight asking your support for this country over the next decade. Thank you.
In the days after the speech, Tom Hayden says Kennedy campaign staffers were on the phone.
And his advisors were calling back, asking the people in Ann Arbor what the hell this proposal was, and could somebody send some information about what he had endorsed.
Longtime Kennedy aide Ted Sorensen says that challenge to the students wasn't planned, but it fit in nicely with Kennedy's New Frontier campaign.
Kennedy spoke not of a specific organization with a specific name, but with the general idea, which was consistent with the whole theme of his campaign, which was public service and young people dedicating their energies and talents.
No one knew it then, but in just a few weeks, that challenge would have a name: the Peace Corps. Coming up, the students take up the challenge, and Kennedy commits to the idea on Kennedy and the Peace Corps, Idealism on the Ground. You're listening to Kennedy and the Peace Corps, Idealism on the Ground. I'm Lester Graham. Alan and Judy Guskin, like a lot of students at the University of Michigan, were pretty excited about Senator Kennedy campaigning at their school. They listened, not quite sure what to do about the challenge he made or why he had chosen that moment to make it.
Somehow, and nobody knows exactly why, he was inspired to point to the crowd and challenge us. He knew that we were students, that we had certain skills, that we had certain backgrounds, and he challenged us to use our knowledge, our skills, in the third world.
A student named Phil Power was a night reporter for the Michigan Daily newspaper. He says at that moment, not many knew what to think about the challenge.
It was almost in a parenthesis. The idea came, he flicked it out, and then it went away. People said, okay, he gave a speech. It's an interesting idea. It's late. Let's go have a beer. Let's go to bed.
And that could have been the end of it. But a few days later, an advisor to the Kennedy campaign made a stop on campus. Alan and Judith Guskin went to hear him.
Chester Bowles came, who was the foreign policy advisor to John Kennedy in the campaign. And somebody in the audience asked Chester Bowles a question about what John Kennedy proposed on the 14th about sending young people overseas to serve in the undeveloped world. And he then talked about his son and daughter-in-law serving in Africa. And it really stimulated a lot of us.
Here was someone who had been ambassador to India, who knew about foreign affairs, who had a son, Sam, and a daughter-in-law, Sally, working in a village in Africa. And he was very proud of them, and he felt they were doing meaningful work. And that's what really, I think, made the difference for us. We said, okay, why not? This is real.
And so my then wife and I went to eat dinner in the basement of the restaurant, took out a napkin, and I wrote with her a letter to the Michigan Daily, urging people to sign up for what Kennedy had proposed.
We did not have any background in our family in foreign service at all. We had not traveled abroad, but we felt the time was right to do something personal and to make a difference. You know, the civil rights movement had already started, and there were activities on campus. The idea of direct participation, of action, as those words were put in our letter, were words of the times, of those who were making commitments to do something.
In that letter, the Guskins called on students to take up John Kennedy's challenge, meet with them to determine how a program for youth to help overseas could work. They took the note they first wrote down on a napkin to the editor of the Michigan Daily, Tom Hayden, and told him, "You've got to publish this."
I could see him now, 18 years old, sitting in his chair, moving the chair back a bit because it made him look more like the editor, I think. And we were excited, and we said, you know, here's a letter we want you to publish. And I do remember he said, little bit, you know, why should I? Or, you know, you can't tell me what to publish. And then he read it, and he agreed, and he was quite pleased over the time that followed, over the many meetings on campus, that this was going on. He was very excited himself.
Tom Hayden says he doesn't remember that specific moment all that well, but he remembers committing to the idea.
They drew me into a decision where I committed the resources of the paper to editorializing in favor of their proposal. They published a letter to the editor. I spoke at one of their gatherings, and on they went to make history.
The response to the Guskins' letter to the editor and the buzz from the Kennedy speech on campus was overwhelming. The phone began ringing off the hook in the Guskins' apartment. As a reporter for the Michigan Daily, Phil Power attended and covered a lot of the meetings Alan and Judy Guskin organized.
He started a little organization called Americans Committed to World Responsibility, which is kind of a high-flying name for a bunch of kids who were sitting around and drinking too much coffee and too much beer too late at night.
Hundreds of students at the University of Michigan got involved. So did some of the faculty. And they started putting together a plan of how college grads could go abroad, could, through a government program, take their skills and knowledge to people in other countries. Students from other campuses heard about the effort through their campus newspapers. Phil Power says for a decade, there have been young people starving for something more than just trudging through life pursuing a career.
Remember, this was in the 1950s, which was the time of the man in the gray flannel suit. And a lot of young people were passive about political or social action. The country had come through World War II, come through the Korean War. Dwight Eisenhower was the president. The Cold War was going, and policy issues were denominated to some degree in military terms. And from a standpoint of enthusiastic, passionate, involved young people, there was very little there for us in the national conversation.
No one involved in dreaming up what would become the Peace Corps would claim this was an original idea. Minnesota Senator Hubert Humphrey had tried to get such a program passed in Congress. Other politicians had proposed similar programs. Religious groups, such as the Mennonites, had their own programs in place. And private organizations had varying degrees of success in getting students overseas to a life of service among the villages and big cities in third world countries. As a teenager, Douglas Kelly had been inspired by a program put together by Eleanor Roosevelt. It encouraged young people to think about service to others. In 1951, as a college student, he helped create the International Development Placement Association to place people in jobs alongside organizations and governments in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. He says getting money to operate was always a struggle, and he remembers pleading his case to a program officer in the Ford Foundation.
He listened carefully and respectfully to my pitch for big money, which would enable us to put on a really large-scale program rather than the small pilot projects that we were working on. He listened to what I had to say, and then he shook his head and he said, "There just aren't enough young Americans that want to do that kind of thing." Those words are emblazoned on my brain, and I'll never forget them because 9 years later, John F. Kennedy was willing to gamble on the altruism of Americans in a way that a foundation official was unwilling to take the chance.
In 1960, the students trying to put together this new proposal quickly found themselves in the middle of politics. Influential professors at the University of Michigan called Allen and Judith Guskin, asking them to pitch the idea to both presidential candidates.
They wanted Kennedy to come out for the Peace Corps, but they said, "We love this idea too much to let it be totally partisan." And they asked us to please contact the Nixon campaign as well. We followed their advice reluctantly at the time.
Well, we were not very happy about that, but we did. Turns out the head of the Mental Health Research Institute was the head of the professors for Nixon. And so we talked to him, and he got in contact with the Nixon campaign, and they rejected it. And Nixon later, of course, came out and called it a kiddie corps.
With a quick and firm no from the Nixon campaign, the Guskins concentrated on getting their proposal to the Kennedy camp. One of the Kennedy campaign organizers in Michigan was a United Auto Workers official, Millie Jeffrey. Her daughter was involved in the effort at the University of Michigan. Millie Jeffrey became the liaison between the students and the Kennedy campaign, and only a couple of weeks after the candidate spoke to the students, he made a decision.
We got word from Millie Jeffrey. In fact, Judy answered the phone and was shocked. Millie Jeffrey said that the senator would like to see you tomorrow morning when he comes to Toledo, Ohio. He's giving a speech tonight, this is November 2nd, in which he's going to commit himself to the Peace Corps, and he's going to mention the University of Michigan group. Well, we were bowled over, to say the least.
She called me at home and said, "Judy, he's coming out for it, and he wants to meet you." At which point I sat down, took a deep breath, and asked her to repeat what she had just said.
Just a few days before the election, John Kennedy was to give a speech that mentioned the University of Michigan group and used the term Peace Corps for the first time. Ted Sorensen is reported to be the author of that Kennedy speech.
He was making a speech on peace in San Francisco, and he included in that speech a change in U.S. foreign policy, philosophy, and approach to emphasize international organizations and international law, number one, to emphasize disarmament and arms control with a specific agency in the U.S. government for that purpose, number two, and the whole idea of a Peace Corps spelled out with some specifics, but nothing like the details that would come along later. And that was the third major subject of that speech.
The next morning, while Kennedy was flying from San Francisco to Toledo, Ohio, The Guskins gathered a small group of students and took a couple of cars to the Toledo airport to meet with Senator Kennedy and present the hundreds of petitions of people who had committed to their plan.
We arrived and waited on the tarmac for the Caroline plane to land. The senator got off the plane with Ted Sorensen and Richard Goodwin and Millie Jeffrey, and they came over to the small group of us, and I had the honor of showing the senator the petitions. He had been told, probably by Millie Jeffrey, that we didn't have any copies of these petitions. There were no Xerox machines for us, and we kept the original, and we were going to organize, and we needed the names. So he looked down at me, and he said, "I think you need to keep these, right?" And I said, "Yes, Senator." I wasn't about to give it to him, even though he could be president very soon.
There was no press there except for the Michigan Daily. Kind of interesting. Always been surprised at that, every time I think of that. So why wouldn't you have press there if it was a really political thing? It was the last few days of the campaign. It was, it turns out, a very important part of those last few days. It's the only program, I was told, he committed himself to publicly during the campaign, but in a powerful way, and yet didn't invite the press there. Kind of interesting. He just wanted to see us.
Election day in 1960 was November 8th, and late into the night, the race was close. When John F. Kennedy emerged the next day as president-designate, his new frontier was about to dawn.
John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
That you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
On Inauguration Day, January 20th, 1961, President Kennedy summed up in a few simple words how he envisioned America would keep the peace and extend freedom in the world.
To those people in the huts and villages of half the globe struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves. For whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich.
And Kennedy told the nation it would require the people of the United States to get involved.
I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
The Kennedy administration hit the ground running. Scott Stossel wrote the authorized biography of Sergeant Shriver, John Kennedy's brother-in-law, and the man Kennedy wanted to pull together a plan to create the Peace Corps.
Shriver had been in Washington with his family for the festivities surrounding the inauguration. He'd just flown back to Chicago where he was living, and the phone rang, and Eunice, his wife, who was the president's sister, answered. It was Jack Kennedy on the line, and Jack and Eunice talked for a bit, and then Eunice said, "Sarge, the president wants to talk to you." And he said, "Sarge, I want you to come back and help me start this Peace Corps." So it was right away.
In a month, February 22nd, Shriver sent a memo to President Kennedy outlining a plan to establish the Peace Corps. The last line says, "If you decide to go ahead on these, we can be in business Monday morning." again Shriver biographer Scott Stossel.
It was astonishingly fast, and it was the combination of sort of the energy of the Kennedy administration with the supercharged dynamic energy of Shriver himself. And he really didn't understand how the bureaucracy worked and how red tape worked, which worked to his advantage because he just would shred it or go around any bureaucratic impediments.
In the memo to the president, Shriver had suggested several well-qualified people to head up the new Peace Corps. As he noted in an interview with Douglas Cater in 1964, he didn't think Kennedy had him in mind to run the program.
When we made the presentation to President Kennedy about the Peace Corps, the last paragraph in the presentation included a list of about six or seven men that I recommended to run the Peace Corps, and none of them were myself.
But it would prove to be a good choice. President Kennedy's aide, Ted Sorensen, was also involved in setting up this new Peace Corps. He says the White House knew it would be a tough sell on Capitol Hill.
Congress is Congress, and the people on the right thought it would be a boondoggle. They don't like foreign aid. They don't like spending money to help those in the developing world. Those on the left were fearful that it would become a front or cover for the CIA.
So he says President Kennedy bypassed Congress in the short term.
He didn't want to wait for Congress to debate the issue. And so I think it was March 1, which considering the fact that he entered office only on noon January 20 was pretty fast. On March 1, he issued an executive order establishing the Peace Corps, so that while Congress debated, we could be setting it up.
I have today signed an executive order providing for the establishment of a Peace Corps on a temporary pilot basis. I'm also sending to Congress a message opposing authorization of a permanent Peace Corps.
The president said he hoped to have up to 1,000 volunteers in the field by the end of 1961.
None of the men and women will be paid a salary. They will live at the same level as the citizens of the country which they're sent to, doing the same work, eating the same food, speaking the same language. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health. I'm hopeful that it will be a source of satisfaction to Americans and a contribution to world peace.
When we return, getting Congress on board and keeping the CIA out. You're listening to Kennedy and the Peace Corps, Idealism on the Ground. This is Kennedy and the Peace Corps, Idealism on the Ground. I'm Lester Graham. As Sergeant Shriver began putting together his team, he recruited a young aide to Vice President Lyndon Johnson, a guy named Bill Moyers. Moyers has said if the vice presidency is the most boring job in the country, well, then Moyers had the second most boring job.
I finagled my way out of his clutches with the reluctant approval of John F. Kennedy and joined the Peace Corps organizing group in March of 1961 because I wanted to be where this action was. I wanted to be where something new was being born. I wanted to be part of what was going to embody the new frontier.
Bill Moyers admits taking an idea put together by university students and turning it into a worldwide program was idealistic, not the kind of thing that the Washington establishment looked on kindly, but it worked.
The early 60s was a time when it became permissible to be idealistic. Cynicism was not an acceptable value in the early 1960s, and incarnated in John F. Kennedy was this notion that it was all right, it was approved that you could be idealistic and people wouldn't laugh at you. To volunteer for the Peace Corps in the early 60s was to be Don Quixote and Galahad. It cast in one volunteer. It was romantic. It was that we were celebrities. The Peace Corps was the newest celebrity in the new frontier. It was exciting. There's a lot of attention to it. The slogan that we created at the Peace Corps that was on every college campus was, "What in the world are you doing?" And that became the great compelling allure of the Peace Corps. Go out in the world and do something.
But getting Congress to make the Peace Corps permanent would take more than idealism. Biographer Scott Stossel says it turned out Sergeant Shriver did better in the halls of Congress than anyone expected.
When it came time to try and get legislation passed, Shriver just absolutely assaulted Capitol Hill, and he and his deputy, Bill Moyers, lived on Capitol Hill. They'd have breakfast meetings with one congressman, lunch meetings with another, dinner meetings with a third, you know, meetings in between all those meals. And then he'd just sort of stroll the halls of the Congress late into the night and see who was still around. And if he saw an open door, he'd walk in and buttonhole whoever was in there and basically preach about the virtues of the Peace Corps. And they ended up passing the legislation by an overwhelming amount. And a lot of the congressmen that he spoke to said, you know, I wasn't really sold on the program, but I was sold on Shriver. This guy was such a good salesman and such a charming guy and so clearly believed in what he was selling that I couldn't say no.
Members of Congress weren't the only ones who couldn't say no to the Peace Corps. The intelligence community saw the Peace Corps as a golden opportunity. If they could get operatives into some of these countries in the guise of do-gooder kids, they might learn a lot. Scott Stossel says that idea was not the face of America President Kennedy intended to present to the world when he moved forward with the Peace Corps.
This was all taking place in the context of the very high-stakes Cold War with, you know, nuclear Armageddon sort of hovering always in the background and the contest for the hearts and minds of the world. And so, you know, President Kennedy himself and Shriver, too, recognized that the world would view with suspicion, you know, a bunch of American kids running around, particularly if there was, you know, also Marxists running around in some of these countries, it would be seen as sort of spies or clandestine attempts to overthrow the government or to oppose, you know, Marxist authorities there. If there were any perception or certainly, you know, any discovery that the CIA or any other kind of covert organization had infiltrated the Peace Corps and was using it as an intelligence gathering operation or, you know, for spying or, you know, God forbid, for, you know, assassinations or something like that, it would totally blow up the Peace Corps. I mean, that would be the end of it.
Generally speaking, Sergeant Shriver avoided taking advantage of his family ties to the president. But when he suspected the Peace Corps was being infiltrated by the intelligence community, he felt he had to make a call to his brother-in-law.
Hi, how are you?
Good, fine.
I'm sorry to bother you, but I'm getting rather suspicious over here that despite your instructions, that some of our friends over in the Central Intelligence Agency might think that they're smarter than anybody else and that they're trying to stick fellas into the Peace Corps.
Yeah.
John McConus told me on two or three occasions, and Dulles, of course, did, that they never would do that.
Right.
They sent out messages and the rest of it.
Right.
But we've got a group in training now that looks suspicious. And I'd like to follow whatever you recommend, but I sure in hell want those.
Oh, you call Dick Helms?
Dick Helms?
Yeah, he's the operation officer over there under. Just say to him, if you talk to me, and I don't want anybody in there.
Okay.
And if they are there, let's get them out now before we have it. And if there's any problem about it, then Dick Helms ought to call the president about it. But this is we're very, very anxious that there be no, we don't want to discredit this whole idea.
Okay, fine.
And they're not going to find out that much intelligence. Now, the other thing is, I noticed with these people coming back, can we do anything about seeing if we can get some of them to go in the Foreign Service?
Yes, the Foreign Service has already changed their examination schedules and the kind of exams they give and the places that they're going to be given and done everything that they think they can this year to facilitate Peace Corps guys getting into the Foreign Service. And USIA has done the same thing, and AID is trying to do something.
Yeah.
I think we'll have to find out by one trial run to see whether it's successful.
Okay, well, I just wanted to be let me know if there's anything we can do, because these are the guys I'd like to get in the Foreign Service.
Okay, fine.
Okay,
thanks.
Bye, sir.
It's notable that Kennedy is still concerned about getting people who can speak the language and understand different cultures into the Foreign Service to replace the tennis and cocktails crowd. Back in Michigan, the students who embraced Kennedy's challenge and proposed the Peace Corps, Alan and Judy Guskin, were ecstatic that the president was making the Peace Corps a priority. But they were still in school, finishing up their studies. Alan Guskin was about to get a teaching position under his mentor at the University of Michigan, but that plan was about to change.
The Peace Corps was looking for people who could help in the selection division, people who were psychologists, social psychologists, and so on. And so the head of the selection in the Peace Corps, a man named Nicholas Hobbs, a well-known psychologist, called my mentor, Professor Ted Newcomb, at the University of Michigan, who was head of the social psych program, and asked Ted Newcomb if he had any graduate students who would fit what they need. Nick Hobbs did not know anything about my involvement in the whole business of talking to Kennedy and the Peace Corps movement and so on.
Both Alan and Judith Guskin went to work in Washington, And it didn't take long before the Peace Corps found out it had just hired the very students who had proposed the program to Kennedy. After a stint as selection officers, the Guskins decided that's all fine and good, but that original idea of going overseas and helping people was the real goal. And so they signed up as volunteers to go to Thailand. That landed them back at the University of Michigan. The Peace Corps training for Thailand was to take place there. They learned to speak the language. They learned about the culture. They became the kind of Americans Kennedy wanted to represent the U.S. in foreign lands.
We were Kennedy's children. That's what the Peace Corps was called. We were the President Kennedy's children. And so when we arrived in country, we were just wined and dined. In the first 7 days, we were wined and dined by 4 or 5 ministers in the Thai government. So it was an incredible experience. Everybody was shocked that most of us could speak Thai fairly decently, at least to get along. There was a famous picture in the Bangkok papers of the Prime Minister of Thailand putting out his hand to shake the hand of the Peace Corps volunteer. And the Peace Corps volunteer is in a Y, sort of, which is both hands clasped in front of you at your chest or at your head level, depending upon at what you're doing. And so there's a putting out the hand to shake so the Prime Minister could do the proper thing for Americans, and the Americans doing the proper thing for saying hello to a Thai.
The Guskins were not the only ones to get the call from the Peace Corps. Douglas Kelly, the man who'd helped found one of the prototypes to the Corps, the International Development Placement Association, received a telegram from Sergeant Shriver that said in part, "If you want to work for Peace Corps, come to Washington Monday for an interview." That's the same day Shriver would give President Kennedy the plan for the new program. Kelly said he'd just received scholarships to attend Harvard and wasn't able to go to work for the Peace Corps immediately.
But a year later, having finished the coursework at Harvard, I did go to work under Shriver and Bill Moyers as Peace Corps' Community Relations Director.
But Doug Kelly, just like the Guskins, eventually realized he wanted to do the work of a volunteer on the ground. In the small print of the Peace Corps regulations, volunteers could take their families. And so Douglas Kelly, his wife, and their 2 small boys trained to go to Cameroon.
They learned Pidgin English pretty well because once you got out of the major cities in Cameroon, you would need to be able to speak in Pidgin. For time you de go for Cameroon, them people go like them time no day. If you fit talk Daso Pidgin, them people de talk say, "We know Saba your Latin grammar. We don't understand your Latin grammar," which is what they called and may still call proper English. So my kids spoke Pidgin well enough that sometimes when inside the house I heard them playing with neighborhood kids, I wasn't sure if it was my kids speaking or some of the neighborhood kids.
The Peace Corps, as envisioned by college students, had been realized by a young president who felt the United States had to do more than be strong militarily. It had to show the world Americans were willing to work and live among the people of the world, helping in whatever way they could. Even with other foreign policy stumbles, such as the bumbled Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, Kennedy could point to the Peace Corps as a better example of America's willingness to work with the people of other countries. It was the representation of America President Kennedy had hoped to see, and did, before he was taken from the nation.
President Kennedy was shot today just as his motorcade left downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy. She cried, "Oh no." The motorcade sped on.
The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
This flash, 2 priests who were with President Kennedy say he has died of bullet wounds.
White House Press Secretary Malcolm Kilduff has just announced that President Kennedy died at approximately 1 o'clock Central Standard Time, which is about 35 minutes ago.
Almost every American alive on November 22, 1963, remembers where they were when they heard the news of President Kennedy's assassination. Peace Corps volunteers scattered around the globe might not have heard the news that day, but the impact was universal. Alan and Judith Guskin were in Thailand.
I was in Bangkok, was in a Chinese pharmacy. The Chinese pharmacist could not speak English. and had trouble speaking Thai, and he kept putting his finger to his temple and sort of pointing as if a gun was shooting into his head. It was very, very strange behavior. We left there immediately, Judy and I. We went back to our house and tried to put on the radio, could not figure out what was going on. And then the student that was living with us came home and told us that the President Kennedy had been killed.
The next day, Kennedy's picture was in many prominent places on campus. There was black ribbon on the railings, and my students came up to me with tears in their eyes, saying how sorry they felt about what had happened. It was an amazing experience for me to have so many of the students and faculty feeling so strongly about this. And later I learned in small villages all throughout the country, people cried.
Peace Corps volunteers reported for years later they found in mud huts in the most remote areas of the world photos of John Kennedy hanging on the wall. In William Manchester's book, Death of a President, he describes the scene at the White House on the day President Kennedy was to be buried. Dignitaries of the world heard Emperor Haile Selassie declare that Ethiopia needed no new Kennedy monument because the president's memory was enshrined forever in the work of the Peace Corps. Kennedy's aide, Ted Sorensen, says in 3 short years, Kennedy left a lasting legacy of working toward peace, civil rights, space exploration, but he had a special fondness for the Peace Corps.
Well, I can just tell you that John F. Kennedy himself loved the Peace Corps and loved those volunteers. Sometimes groups of Peace Corps volunteers, before they shipped out, would come and meet with the president in the Rose Garden behind the White House. And he loved talking to them, meeting them, wishing them well. He was very proud that the Peace Corps was as well received as it was by foreign governments. He was very proud that it had a record of goodwill and good works. So I think as proud as he would be of the other parts of his legacy, I'm sure he would be happy to see the Peace Corps rank right up there.
The Peace Corps had gone from a candidate's idealistic, abstract thought, an ad-lib line in a speech to students on a chilly night at the University of Michigan, to volunteers on the ground in countries around the world in just a few months. The first deputy director of the Peace Corps, Bill Moyers, says it was a moment in history that combined the right leader, the right atmosphere in the country, and young people willing to take up the challenge.
You had a young, idealistic president who understood the world, and he made the speech. It touched, who knows when the seed becomes a blossom that becomes a flower. And it happened that night, not from the speech alone, not because Kennedy was charismatic, but because there were gathered in front of him as he spoke some people whose hearts and souls and minds were the fertile ground on which that seed fell.
Over the years, more than 200,000 people have volunteered their time and skills to countries abroad through the Peace Corps. Judith Guskin and Alan Guskin say they, like many others who served, feel the Peace Corps changed lives.
And I think the Peace Corps means more to the world and to Americans than the students taught, the schools built, the clinics set up. It represents the value of service. Working as Americans, side by side with host nationals, as colleagues, not as the expert with all the answers. The Peace Corps gave a different image of America. We learned the languages and the cultures of the people, and we respected the differences that we learned about. It changed us, it made us better human beings, and I believe it changed many of the people we worked with as well.
It was never meant to be an economic and social development in a grand scale. It was meant to be a people-to-people program, and as a result, people were changed, all over the world by their interactions with Peace Corps volunteers and given opportunities that they probably never would have had. If you look at it in terms of economic and social development, I'd say, well, the Peace Corps falls short. But that never was really the ultimate purpose of the Peace Corps. It's been the most fantastic people-to-people program ever created. It's just amazing the impact it's had on leaders, people who are now leaders, in all walks of life in their countries. And it's had enormous impact on people in the United States. I mean, there are 200,000 people who've come back. Some of them were conservative, some were liberal, some were just middle-of-the-road people politically, some were teachers, some were business people, some were craftspeople. But every one of them was profoundly changed by what happened to them in the Peace Corps.
Kennedy and the Peace Corps, Idealism on the Ground, was written, produced, and narrated by Lester Graham. Production help came from Paul Long, Shay Shackelford, Samara Freemark, Ethan Lindsay, Sabri Benesher, Trisha Graham, KUOW Seattle, WAMU Washington, the Vincent Voice Library at Michigan State University, the American Presidency Project at the University of California, Santa Barbara, the Presidential Timeline, the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library, and the Democratic Archive in Ann Arbor. Kennedy and the Peace Corps, Idealism on the Ground, is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan.